Welcome. You're here with Animal Voices. This is Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. My name is Allart, and in the studio with me are my co-hosts, Carl Loskin and Marge Adams, and we have Alan Jensen on sound. Today we have a couple of guests for you and some stories for you. Let's go through our co-hosts and find out what everybody's bringing to the show.
Yes, my guest at the top of the show is going to be Dr. Rob Bennett. And Dr. Bennett is an entomologist living in Victoria, and we'll be talking primarily about spiders.
Okay, and after that, I will be bringing in Jeff Erton. He's with the SPCA, with the Farm Animal Transportation Act, and he's going to be telling us with the farm animal welfare and advocacy issues with the BC SPCA. And Carl, what about you?
Yes, we'll do some movie reviews. The 11th Hour is now showing Leonardo DiCaprio's movie, which I saw by kind courtesy of the Sierra Legal Defense Club last night. And we'll also let you know about another movie showing this weekend. It's called at the Cinematheque. It's called Your Mommy Kills Animals. And we'll discuss a bit about the Animal Enterprise Act as well. So over to you.
All right. And Alan, our guest has just called in. Okay, Marge, why don't you go ahead and introduce our guest?
Yes, hi, Bob. Are you there and can you hear me?
Hello, Marge. Nice to talk with you again.
Yes, nice to have you back on the show, Rob. Now, I know that you have a tremendous interest in spiders. I'm sure that you're interested in a lot of other little critters as well. But I felt we didn't quite finish the questions at last interview, and I want to resume. You have a real interest in spiders, and give us a little background on how that developed, will you?
Certainly. Well, for me, I think the main reason people, or, such as myself or anybody for that matter, would be interested in spiders is that they are really amazing organisms in terms of life on Earth. Their natural history is quite fascinating. You know, each spider on the face of the Earth is a solitary living predator, and because of that, they've evolved some fantastic behavior patterns, for instance, in how they capture their prey, how they interact with one another. Like if you're a predator and you kill and eat anything that crosses your path, how do you get together with a member of the opposite sex in your species to mate and successfully reproduce? And their effects on insect populations around the world are truly dramatic. All these sort of things make spiders, in my mind, exceedingly interesting organisms to study. But there are other reasons as well. You know, people have been fascinated by spiders, I think, since the dawn of time. If you look at any culture on the face of the earth, they all have some sort of aspect of spiders incorporated into their folklore. Even for us, talking about myself as a native white person, you know, we have the relatively banal folklore associated with Little Miss Muffet, but a lot of the other cultures on the face of the earth have spiders in their mythology and folklore in the same way as West Coast native populations have ravens in theirs. The spider is often featured as a trickster, similar to the way ravens are in West Coast mythology. And then in terms of economics, too, spider silk, for instance, is phenomenally strong, probably the strongest naturally occurring fiber known to the face of humans. And for that reason, textile industries, for instance, I lived in North Carolina for a while, and when I was there, was involved a little bit with textile industries, cotton is big in North Carolina, and textile manufacturing is, and they had a research program going on trying to figure out how to make spider silk in sufficient quantities to make it economically viable for production of silk textiles. So the spider silk is vastly superior to the standard silk that's made from silkworm moths. And the eventual upshot of that, when I was living in North Carolina, was in the early 80s, it was before the genetic modification era, and now that genetic technology has come online, there is now a company in Montreal that successfully manufactures spider silk using goats, of all things, through a genetic modification system, and the silk is to be marketed under a trademark, I think it's called BioSteel. And the target market is body armor, but also for dressings for wounds, because spider silk works very, very well to staunch blood flow and other things, and it also has antibiotic characteristics that make it very good as a wound dressing.
Mm, that's amazing.
So there you are in a nutshell. Why someone like me with a PhD in science would have an interest in spiders?
Yes, in fact, they're not even insects, are they? Entomologists, according to my dictionary anyway, are people who study insects.
And that's what my paid employment is. Certainly my interest in spiders would be should be termed as arachnology, or even more specifically, araneology. Unfortunately, jobs are not quite so numerous in the araneology and arachnology fields as they are in entomology. Mm-hmm. So when I graduated, the job that I ended up with is, as it is now, working with the Ministry of Forests as an insect specialist. So technically, I'm an entomologist, but my heart is with araneology.
I see. Maybe the jobs aren't there, though, huh?
Well, the jobs that I was training for were museum-oriented jobs, being a museum curator, preserving specimens, describing species, describing distribution and abundance of species, that sort of thing. And there are very few jobs in museums now. The Royal BC Museum has a spider curator there who I work fairly closely with, Claudia Copley, working with Rob Cannings as the head entomology curator at the Royal BC Museum. They have quite a substantial collection of spiders there. But those sort of institutions are relatively rare on the face of the earth. There's only so much room for people working in those fields.
I can imagine. One thing that I just like to mention that you stated was that spider webs staunch bleeding. Now, I imagine the native people must have used that.
It's my understanding that spider webbing has been used since people started killing or hurting each other, or since people fell down cliffs and bled. They discovered very early on that spider silk webbing, it serves to just block the flow of blood and give blood more of an opportunity to clot, the natural clotting process. But there also is some amount of antibiotic activity that's associated with spider webbing that probably wasn't immediately apparent to folks using it prehistorically. But yes, it's been used for a long time, featured in the accounts of ancient battles and that sort of thing. And actually, slightly related to that, an interesting story, again, with the cultural use of spider webs in the 1700s. There's a famous story in Scottish history about Robert de Bruce escaping the searching bands of British soldiers who were looking for him at the time. He was hiding in a cave, and in the night, a spider built a web across the entrance to the cave that he was in. And because of the spider web over the entrance to the cave, the British soldiers walking by there assumed that there was nothing inside there, because if anything had gone in, it would have broken the web. Of course, they didn't understand, as you and I know now, that spiders often build their webs, rebuild them on a day-to-day basis. If they'd known that, they would have thought, ha, there could have been somebody in there, because this web is only 24 hours old at the oldest.
Ah, yes. Now, there's something that you refer to as mythology of spiders. Will you tell us about that?
Well, there are various aspects of spider mythology. I mentioned some a little earlier in our talk, but what is of greatest interest to me these days, and has been for about a decade, is the spider mythology associated around spider bites. There's a huge amount of mythology about spiders, particularly the brown recluse spider, for instance, but other spiders elsewhere in the world. Brown recluse, of course, is quite big in the mythology for North America, but also quite close to home. There's a lot of mythology surrounding the hobo spider, which is quite common in southern BC, which a species that was not native to the spider fauna here, but was introduced from Great Britain about 75 or 80 years ago. And there's quite a preponderance of misdiagnoses of various medical conditions as being the result of spider bites, in spite of the fact that there's little or no evidence for this sort of thing actually occurring. And these can range from fatal medical conditions such as cutaneous anthrax, syphilis, various cancers, even things like Lyme disease, have been relatively routinely misdiagnosed as being the result of spider bites, usually a brown recluse spider bite. And again, in fact, in lack of any evidence to suggest that that spiders are causing these sorts of things. And myself, I'm sort of a small player in the spider bite mythology field, but I have a close friend and colleague, Rick Vetter, from the University of California at Riverside. He and I have published articles together, and he, in particular, we wrote two articles that appeared in Canadian Family Physician in 2004, in August and November 2004, regarding spider bite mythology, with specific emphasis on the Canadian situation. And Rick has also published widely in much more well-known medical journals such as Lancet and the New England Journal of Medicine on the silliness that's involved with doctors and the public assuming that spider bites can cause these horrible lesions that people think they do. So that's the spider bite mythology aspect, and still fairly active in that field. Rick actually has just finished writing a review article for one of the big entomology publications called the Annual Review of Entomology, and this outlines the whole scenario around the world of spider bite mythology, and will be published sometime in 2008.
Mm-hmm. Alan, do you have a question?
Oh, yeah. Hi, Rob. This is Alan.
Hello.
I do have a short question, but I am the operator here as well. And the phone, it's going up fine over the air, but your phone is sort of going up and down in volume a little bit. So if you could speak sort of loudly and directly into the phone, it would work better for us.
All right. I'll give you my basal profundo voice.
Excellent. And I'll do the same. And my quick question is about the number of spider species. We know there are huge numbers of insect species in the world. Are spiders as profuse?
Less so, because they are entirely predatory, whereas insects cover the whole gamut of organisms that feed on decaying matter, feed on plants, and also are predators, etc., etc. But in terms of the world spider population, we think there are about 250,000 spider species in the world. Of that amount, only about 40,000 have been cataloged, i.e. they've been given Latin names like Nephosa snowholmish or whatever, and described in the scientific literature. In terms of Canada, if you can think of glaciation in Canada, up to 10,000 years ago, Canada was scoured by ice, so there was very little living here at that time. So our fauna has all come up from southern areas after the ice receded. So we don't have a huge spider fauna here, but we do have, currently we know of at least 1,500 spider species that occur in Canada. And the neat thing about living in BC, where habitats are so diverse, is that we have fully half of those that number of species occur here in Canada, including most of the really interesting spiders Canada's tarantula-type population. There are only 7 species of tarantula-type spiders in Canada, and 6 of them occur here in BC and only 1 somewhere else.
None of our native ones were dangerous, though. Is that right?
There's been the mythology associated with the hobo spider, which we've tried very hard to dispel. We do have native black widow spiders. Most of the dry southern valleys in British Columbia have black widow spider populations, and they can be exceedingly numerous. For instance, here where I live on the Saanich Peninsula, there's probably the biggest black widow spider population I've ever found anywhere, or at least the most dense, on one of the beaches on the inside of the Saanich Peninsula. Huge population on a beach where people are playing and recreating on a regular basis around the entire year. Nobody's ever been bitten by a black widow spider, as far as I'm aware of there, even though people are handling logs and other debris under which these spiders are very numerous. So the black widow spider is potentially dangerous to humans. It has what we call a neurotoxic venom that wouldn't cause any local reactions if you were to be unfortunate enough to actually be bitten by one. The venom acts in a systemic manner over the entire body and in general produce tetanus-like symptoms. But the fact of the matter is nobody ever gets bitten by them, and why worry about it? You're better off making sure that you've got good tires on your bicycle, because you're more likely to hurt yourself wiping out on a bicycle with bad tires than you are ever of being bitten by a black widow spider.
Mm-hmm. This is Albert. I have a question. I wanted to go back to when you were talking about spider bikes, because I had an experience when I was about 16 years old where, I guess where we were living, there was spiders happening. But I would wake up in the morning with these bite marks, which would then be welts on my arms. Now, one day, I had a welt, and I'd been scratching it all day, but underneath a long-sleeved sweater, and didn't really realize what I was scratching. I just knew I was scratching it all day. And later on in the day, I pulled up my sleeve, and from that welt, which was near my elbow, there was a red line that was going all the way up my arm, and I ran home and took off my shirt, and it was all the red line was all the way up to my armpit. And so I went to the hospital, and they gave me something and said, it's a good thing that you came here when you did, because you have blood poisoning from this spider bite. So do you want to comment on that?
Well, I'm not a medical doctor, but I would suspect that their diagnosis, blood poisoning, was certainly correct. It certainly sounds like the symptoms that I'm familiar with. The spider bite was erroneous because there's no record anywhere of a spider bite causing any sort of blood poisoning effect like that. It's more likely that you were bitten, and I would believe it's quite likely that you were bitten by some sort of blood-feeding arthropod. My first guess would be fleas, which are prevalent in a lot of places, but there are other ones, even mosquitoes. Bed bugs, of course, are really becoming quite common and in people's minds these days because they're so prevalent in various big cities such as Vancouver. But that's likely what happened to you, was having been bitten by a blood-feeding arthropod, probably a flea, and then subsequently suffering an infection of the bite, which would have been induced, I suspect, by the scratching, but it might have been an infection from the bite. Spiders don't cause those sort of reactions. So the blood poisoning diagnosis was correct, but the spider bite is erroneous. And the attack we take with medical doctors on this idea is that, first of all, particularly if you're in the States, if there was a life-threatening disease involved, you're opening yourself up for litigation because, of course, people love to sue in the United States. If you were diagnosed with a spider bite and you actually had cutaneous anthrax and you died, I'm quite sure that your family would be wanting to question your doctor very closely and perhaps sue for malpractice. And also, if you are misdiagnosed with a condition that, say, you figure it was a brown recluse spider bite, in spite of the fact that there's never been a brown recluse spider collected in Canada and treated for a brown recluse spider bite, the treatment isn't going to be successful. In your case, because they knew it was blood poisoning, that was correct, and they were able to treat you appropriately for that.
Thanks, Rob, for the answer there. Another question I'd like to bring up is global warming. Is that having an impact on the spider population in any way?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So I'm a quite firm believer that climate change is affecting basically everything that we do in the world. And certainly in BC, one of the most obvious effects of climate change in part is the current epidemic of mountain pine beetles in the interior of the province. And with respect to spiders, what I am seeing a lot of lately is the distribution and abundance of certain species is shrinking as their habitats are disappearing. But at the same time, we're also getting interesting spiders that are expanding their ranges northward from areas down in the United States. For instance, my colleague and friend Jacob DeLeese in Nelson a couple of years ago, who's quite a well-known biologist up there, found a new species of tarantula occurring in the Pend'Oreille Valley that previously was only known as far north as Oregon, and we're quite sure that that's a range expansion as a result of climate change and making the climate in southern BC more amenable to the existence of those sort of spiders.
Uh-huh, I see.
And now, it is quite easy to go into any of the southern valleys in BC these days and flip over rocks and logs and come up with species that haven't been recorded previously in Canada.
I guess there are a lot of them to come, aren't there, because there's such a vast number.
It's a continuation, I think, of Canada's rebounding from the ancient glaciers. It's a constant process. Life is not static, and the distributions and abundance of species change. Species will decline and others will improve their lot in life. And I think it's my job as a biologist to try and make sure that certain species don't perhaps suffer extinction at our hands results of climate change.
Yeah, just a brief question about the Committee on Endangered Wildlife in Canada, COSIWIC, I think it's called.
Yes.
Are they doing anything for spiders or other arthropods?
Yes, they are. Traditionally, COSIWIC, which is the Committee on the Status of Endangered Wildlife in Canada, was created to deal with vertebrate issues, you know, things like bald eagles and orcas and that sort of thing. In the last couple of decades, they have certainly expanded their mandate. Plants, botany is a very big thing with COSIWIC now, and more recently, arthropods, in particular the well-known arthropods like butterflies and dragonflies, have played a big role in COSIWIC, and we have endangered species, particularly with butterflies in BC, but also dragonflies. And more recently, just in the last 2 years, I joined COSIWIC with a specific mandate to look at endangered species issues with respect to spiders. We had a meeting in Brandon, Manitoba earlier this summer, and at that meeting I successfully lobbied to have a spider that's only found in small bog areas in the Georgia lowlands and Puget Sound area. So it's a spider of our particular area, mm-hmm. and it will be assessed by COSIWIC over the next year or two to decide whether it deserves to be rated as an endangered species under the mandate of the Species at Risk Act.
We're going to have to end it very soon. So, but I do want to ask you one last question, and I think I can squeeze this in.
All right.
If man eventually destroys himself, what creature is likely to take over the planet?
Well, you and I have discussed this in private in the past. I'm a firm believer that arthropods rule the world. They were here long before humans or vertebrates or higher life forms in general were around, if you higher in quotation marks. And I am quite sure that if we were successful in destroying our species on the face of the earth, that arthropods would soon become the dominant life form again. Again, you can look at the aspect of mountain pine beetle in the interior of the province and realize that there's really nothing we can do about it. They are going to do what they will. And arthropods impact our life in virtually everything that you can imagine. There are arthropods that eat oil, for instance. Arthropods are involved in everything that we do. You may not notice it, but the dried beans that you buy in the store usually have arthropods associated with them, and as long as they don't exceed a certain level, it's legal to sell those. But they are always there. They're in the background. They are lurking, and they are waiting to take over.
Okay. We'll bear that in mind. Thank you so much once again, Rob, for being with us. It's great fun hearing from you and learning more about spiders.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity, Marge. It's been most enjoyable.
Thank you. Bye-bye. You have been listening to an interview with Dr. Rob Bennett, an entomologist living in Victoria.
And this is Vancouver's Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. You're listening to the show Animal Voices. My name is Allert, and that was Marge Jensen with that interview. Now we have an interview with Jeff Erton from the SPCA. He holds a BSE in Animal Science and an MSE in Animal Welfare Science from University of British Columbia. And he currently manages the animal welfare and advocacy issues for the BCSPCA, where he's the Animal Welfare Coordinator. He also sits on the Livestock Working Group for the National Organic Standard and is a director of the Certified Organic Association of British Columbia. And he's going to talk to us about the farm animal welfare work that he's doing. Are you there, Jeff?
Hi, Allert.
Hi.
Nice to be on the show.
Yes, thank you for coming. So, Jeff, tell us a little bit about your work.
Sure thing. Well, I think when most people think of the BCSPCA, they think of companion animals, but we've had a quite active area of work in farm animal welfare programming and advocacy since about the year 2000. And right now we have a couple of people working on two main areas for the organization. We have a farm certification program called SPCA Certified, which we run in order to give consumers certified assurance that products that they're buying in grocery stores are raised to higher animal welfare standards than conventional products. And then another main area of our work is general advocacy on a number of issues. Some of those issues are related to on-farm animal welfare, and some of those issues are related to the practices used to slaughter and transport farm animals. So our main campaign actually right now for farm animal welfare is our farm animal transport campaign.
Tell us a little bit about that.
I'll tell you a little bit about the issue surrounding farm animal transport in Canada. And I think most people on your show have a concept of the magnitude of the numbers of farm animals raised in Canada, but people in general may not realize that over 600 million farm animals are transported throughout Canada each year. Now, the vast majority of that are poultry, but when that sheer magnitude of animals are transported predominantly to auction and to slaughter, you're going to end up in a situation where it's very difficult to regulate and to enforce standards for how those animals are treated during transport.
So what happens to those animals then when it's not monitored?
Mm-hmm. Well, there is, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency does have jurisdiction over monitoring humane transport, and I believe they do what they can right now, given the fact that they have regulations to use that are over 30 years old, and given the fact that the people who are doing that work, doing those inspections, are inadequately funded, really, to be able to monitor all of that the animal transport adequately. But we've ended up in a situation where, because the standards are, the current regulations are, I believe, quite substandard, they're certainly below the requirements in Europe right now. Because animals are permitted to be transported for such long periods of time in crowded conditions, between 2 and 3 million farm animals are actually found dead upon arrival at the slaughterhouse after transport.
This is per year? Each year.
Each year, yeah. So there are, millions of these animals that are certainly dying an inhumane death during transport.
Can you tell us, what is the difference between the European regulations and the regulations here?
Mm-hmm. I can't say I'm an expert on the European regulations, but generally speaking, the transport times are much lower in the EU. So, for example, I think cattle and sheep are the maximum amount of time you can transport cattle and sheep in the EU is around 24 hours. Whereas in Canada, it's 52 hours. That's over 2 days straight in Canada that you can transport cattle and sheep without food, water, or rest. A few other issues in the EU, the density of the animals is not permitted to be as high as in Canada during transport. There are better regulations in the EU that dictate what kinds of injuries and illnesses prevent an animal from being transported. Here in the current regulations, there are some very vague guidelines that stipulate which kinds of animals you shouldn't transport. But in the EU, they have a much more detailed list which stipulates which kinds of injuries would prevent an animal from being transported. And the Canadian Food Inspection Agency has actually proposed some changes to their regulations, and they're sort of working their way through the regulatory process right now. But the farming industry is pressing very hard against some of those changes that the government has proposed.
Why are they pressing against them?
My understanding of their situation is that anything that restricts their freedom to transport animals for longer times or in lower densities is going to decrease their profitability of their business. It's certainly a situation where the industry would rather be much less regulated than they even currently are. But I think in order to ensure that those animals are treated humanely, the government needs to be watching very carefully what's happening, and certainly needs to be keeping Canadian standards in line with the regulations in place in other developed countries around the world. I think Canadians expect that.
So you, when you mentioned that Europe allows for about 24 hours for them to go without food and water, is that correct?
There would actually, in those regulations, there would have, I believe, at some point within that 24-hour period, they would have to provide a rest period.
And what's the Canadian standard with that?
The Canadian standard is 52 hours straight without food and water.
Oh, gee, let's try having a human being go without food and water for 52 hours and see how much they like it. What about in the U.S.?
The U.S., actually, there's been a little bit of regulatory jockeying south of the border lately. It seemed there was some confusion about the existing regulations, but what's come out is that there's in fact what they call a 36-hour law, which prevents farm animals from being transported for longer than 36 hours. Now, I'm not sure exactly which species it applies to. It may not apply to poultry, but it certainly applies to cattle. Even under, I think it's possible that there are some extensions that truckers can apply for south of the border that might increase it even higher than 36 hours, but certainly not as high as Canada permits right now. That 52-hour law is just about the highest in any developing country right now.
And what factor does temperature play in this? Certainly, if animals are being transported in freezing cold weather or in hugely hot weather, how does that affect anything?
That's definitely a major consideration, and that's one of the reasons that in Europe they've now gone to trucks that have active ventilation in them. So you're not just relying on the passive ventilation from the speed of the vehicle down the highway. You actually have fans on board to cool the animals, in summer it's a major problem to try to keep those animals cool. But even in winter, they've done some research recently at the University of Saskatchewan, and even in winter, there are animals in the middle of a poultry truck that are actually dying of heat exhaustion because the animals are packed so densely in there, and the ventilation is just so poor that there are animals dying of heat exhaustion when the ambient temperature outside the truck is 20, 30 below. What this means clearly is that if we're going to continue to transport those kinds of animals, we need to either reduce the density of the animals in those trucks in order to improve the ventilation, or we need to provide active ventilation in those trucks to cool those animals. It's totally unacceptable to me to hear that that there are, in the range of 2 million chickens that die during transport every year just for that very reason.
I saw a film once that it showed some activists that followed some transport trucks and observed what they were doing and what they should have been doing and weren't doing. And with regards to ventilation, there were some of the trucks, I remember there were some pigs in a truck that had, there were a lot of holes, ventilation holes in the side of the truck, but it was a scorching hot day, and so the sun was beaming through those holes, and the pigs were getting sunburned from that, even though there was ventilation.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's another issue. Pigs do not travel well at all. Pigs are prone to travel sickness, and as you've mentioned, they can become sunburned if they're exposed to direct sunlight. There are many issues there that may not be very easy to regulate. So, how can you enforce a regulation that tries to prevent pigs from becoming sunburned? A lot of those kinds of issues come down to the decisions made by the managers, the farm managers who load the animals or the transporters who load the animals and truck them. And it's one of the reasons that we've actually requested in our recommendations to the government that training be made mandatory for farm animal transporters. It seems a little crazy to me that you have requirements in place for dangerous goods truckers, but not for animal truckers. There's no training required right now. So have individuals who may have no experience in handling these animals who are loading them on and off of trucks. You have, may have no experience in gentle driving techniques to minimize the amount of animal flipping and falling that happens in the back of the truck. There have been some industry initiatives lately to start their own, to start industry-led training programs, which I think is a really positive step. But it certainly needs to be made a requirement across Canada, across industries, just as it has in the EU.
Marge has something to say here.
I'm wondering about organic farming. And do the organic farmers who are raising cattle, for example, or broiler chicks and that kind of thing, do they have any better guidelines they follow?
That's a great question, actually. The if we talk about the Certified Organic Associations of BC, their standards stipulate that they have a very general principle that animals in the program that are certified as organic must be cared for and must be handled humanely. But their program, their standards aren't necessarily that specific. I believe there are maximum transport times which are lower than industry standards for organic. And I think another potential benefit of organic products is that you often have the farmer doing their own transport of their animals. Mm-hmm. And I think if you've talked to any of these farmers who have to see their animals leave the farm and not have any control over how they're handled after that point, it's very distressing to a lot of these people who've put a lot of time and care into raising their animals. And so the producers who are transporting their own animals definitely have more control over that. Which is a benefit, and which is more common with the small-scale agriculture, particularly in certified organic. There's certainly no guarantee. So at this time, the certified organic associations don't require training for their transporters and don't inspect transport vehicles.
Jeff, what happens to the downed or the dead animals once they arrive at their destination? They're not included by the manufacturer as part of the product, are they?
No, they're not. They're disallowed from being included in the food chain. The rules for what can go into animal feed, traditionally the dead stock is what they would call those animals. Dead stock may be animals that die on farm or that die during transport. Those animals would often go into animal feed, which could go into feed for poultry or livestock, or it could potentially go into dog food. But those rules have changed quite a lot over the last few years due to the BSE, the mad cow disease issue. And so I can't tell you, I'm completely up to date right now on exactly what is permitted in those feeds, but that's what traditionally would have happened, is that those animals would have gone into the animal food chain, but not the human food chain.
So if they're not going into the animal food chain, how are they getting disposed of?
That's an excellent question. If the animals are dead, their bodies are likely being composted or possibly burned if they feel that there's a disease that might cause risk if the materials... if the materials aren't handled carefully. So, no, that's a good question, but I can't give you a very accurate answer on that one.
And so what amendments are you proposing, and what might be the cost of these amendments?
I'll tell you, to highlight a few of the main changes we'd like to see, we'd certainly like to see lower transport times required by the government, lower animal densities in the trucks, better definitions of what kinds of animals are not permitted to be transported, better ventilation of the trucks and certified training for the truckers. I think we've covered all those points in this interview. I think those are all our most important points. And there's certainly a cost associated with this, though. If you require greater enforcement, or if you require tougher standards to be met, if you require, lower animal densities on the trucks, or you require the trucks to be outfitted with technologies that improve animal welfare, such as ventilation systems, then there's certainly a cost to that. And I don't think the farmer should be paying all of the cost. I think the consumer does need to be willing to pay for part of that cost. And I think if we look back to the origins of intensive agriculture, we'll see that the innovation, shall we say, of systems like battery cages for laying hens or gestation crates for sows, for sows, came about because the consumer demanded a very low price for their product, and as a result, the farmer was put in a situation where they needed to produce more efficiently in order to make a living. So I think any change, any improvement in animal welfare standards, whether it's on farm or in transport, certainly has to be borne partially by the consumer, which is one of the reasons that we have our SPCA certified program, where in order to give the producers in our program who are producing their product to a high standard the opportunity to make a living doing that, they are able to label their product, and the consumer can choose that product over something that's raised conventionally, and generally speaking, those consumers are willing to pay more for it because they know that it was raised to more humane standards.
So at this point, it's a voluntary program, but you'd like to see it be a mandatory program?
Well, I think we're far away from SPCA certified standards being made mandatory within Canada. I think the conventional industry has a long way to go for that, but I think we'd certainly like to see farm animal welfare standards on farm be made mandatory. At this time, all on-farm standards are just voluntary, and there is a national code of practice for each commodity, for each type of animal, that dictates basic principles for how each animal should be raised. But it's not required. The government performs no inspections, and so the only assurance that a consumer can have. That an animal was raised in a certain way is to buy something certified, whether it's SPCA certified or certified organic or some other sort of on-farm certification program.
And what would you suggest people do who are concerned about these issues?
Well, this one particular issue, for the transport issue, we can certainly use your support. So anyone who's interested in showing their support for our recommendations to the government should go to our website, which is www.spca.bc.ca/farminfo, and sign an action letter there to show their support. The SPCA will be getting involved in other campaigns related to farm animals. So if you're interested in keeping updated with those issues, then you can also sign up for our Farm Animal Welfare newsletter, and you'll find the sign-up information on that website as well. And in general, I think these issues come down to food choices. So individuals who have concerns about farm animal welfare should try to find out as much as they can about exactly where their food is coming from and how it was treated, and make their eating choices accordingly.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. Certainly, if you don't want to support the kind of cruelty you've been talking about, then you have an obligation, really, to do a little homework about the food you're buying. Otherwise, if you just say, I don't want to do the homework, then you're creating a disconnect, and you are likely supporting this kind of cruelty. So one can't speak out of both sides of their mouth and say,
absolutely,
you know, I support the welfare of animals, and then say, yeah, but I don't want to even bother to find out where the food comes from or how it got to my plate. So you've given us a lot of information. I really appreciate you coming on our show today, Jeff.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been great to talk about this issue. And I really encourage people to do just as you said and find out a little bit more about where your food comes from. Explore our website, where we talk about a few different issues, and sign up for our newsletter if you're interested in staying regularly updated.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Our guest was Jeff Erton from the SPCA about the Farm Animal Welfare Program. You're listening to Vancouver's Co-op Radio. That's CFRO 102.7 FM. And Alan, you have some music for us.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back. This is Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. Marge, you had a little addendum there.
Yes, I want to mention the website for Rob Bennett, the entomologist who spoke about spiders. If you are interested in learning more about spiders, I'd like you to write this down, please. It's if you click on, eFauna, eFauna .bc.ca, and then click on invertebrates, and then click on spiders, and you'll get the information from not only Rob, but other people as well about spiders.
Thanks. Thank you, Marge. Now, Carl, you've got some stories here.
Yes, coming to a theater near you, and made famous by the movie Titanic. It was the great actor Leonardo DiCaprio who drives a Prius and turned environmental now on the heels of Al Gore's very successful documentary film An Inconvenient Truth. We saw his documentary last night, the new one, which will be showing shortly in the theaters, and it's recommended to see that. But it's called The 11th Hour. Now, Alan Jensen wanted to know what the 11th hour was. Well, according to this environmental time clock, it's got 1 second to go till 12 noon. So we're nearly there. But more about The 11th Hour, and in the film we see many of the clips we've seen on the news in the past years: drought, famine, severe flooding, record rainfall, hurricanes, acid rain, all put together, intermingled together with presentations by Leonardo himself, and keeping good company with Mikhail Gorbachev, Paul Hawken, Stephen Hawken, and David Suzuki. So, worthwhile seeing, and I do feel one thing about the whole environmental issue, and it was also raised when the Inconvenient Truth was being shown, and that we felt that there was another Inconvenient Truth that wasn't getting its proper media attention. And sadly, both Al Gore and this 11th hour, to my mind, missed this gigantic issue, which I would like to explain by mentioning two very landmark studies, which we've mentioned on this show many times before, but I think it's worthwhile repeating. It was a United Nations report by the Food and Agriculture Department, and it identified livestock as the leading cause of CO2 gases, more so that harmful CO2 gases worldwide, more so than all the cars put together on planet Earth. Well, one might wonder why it is that livestock production is so harmful and produces so much harmful CO2 gases, methane, you name it. But it also includes, of course, that we're growing all these crops. We're growing gigantic amount of soya bean, corn. It's on enormous monoculture farms. With tractors and farmers driving around in trucks, and it's being transported gigantic distances. And we're growing these crops and feeding it to animals. And we believe that the turnaround is really very poor, because what's happening here is we're causing all these the CO2 gases with producing all this agriculture, feeding it to animals. And as Dr. Clapper once said, he says, you take 14 pounds between 14 and 16 pounds of grain, and you feed it to the animal, and you get 1 pound of hamburger. Well, but if you take 14 to 16 pounds of grain and you make bread out of it, you can feed enormous amount of people. So what we're doing here is a very inefficient turnaround here. And it's highlighted by this very credible 400-page United Nations Food and Agriculture Study. And the other study, which I think needs to be highlighted also, and it's never mentioned in these two movies, was that it's more beneficial for a person to become a vegan than to switch from a Hummer to a Prius. And the study was covered when you were both traveling 1,500 kilometers a month. So it shows the advantages to the environment of us turning to a plant-based diet. It shows us the advantages of a vegan and a vegetarian diet. And it shows us the advantages of eating lower on the food chain. So that's basically the inconvenient truth that I believe is not being mentioned. The high cost to the environment of growing all this food. And we also know that 70% that livestock production is responsible for 70% of the Amazon rainforest destruction. So, well, so much about that movie, and I hope people will go and see it because it's a good clip. But tonight, there's another movie going to be shown this Saturday, today. Saturday and Sunday. It's called My Mommy Kills Animals, and it is basically being shown at the Pacific Cinematheque at 9:15 Friday, Saturday and Sunday. That's today. And it says it's an in-depth look at the animal rights movement and the FBI's recent declaration calling them the number one domestic terrorist threat in the United States. Well, you might consider that to be a far-out claim, but in the recent election that they had, they included a clause there, which was the Animal Enterprise Act. And in the Animal Enterprise Act in the United States, animal rights persons were classified as terrorists. So in this documentary, you'll see clips from the Animal Liberation Front, the Shack 7, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA. And I'd like to also mention that the Shack 7, they was a court case in Seattle where these seven people were recently convicted. They were convicted of posting the directors' names of the Hunting and Life Sciences, a group that was involved with all kinds of horrendous animal testing, vivisection, animal testing in laboratories. And they posted the names of the directors on their webpage. And the fellow Kevin, for only doing that, Kevin, his last name just escapes me at the moment, who was the leader of the group, was imprisoned for 6 years. He's in prison right now. And the other Shack 6 each received 2 years in prison.
What was the charge?
The charge was that they posted the directors' names on their webpage, on the Animal Liberation Group's webpage.
So is this a privacy issue or a defamation issue?
Well, it's privacy or defamation?
Yeah.
It's not defamation. It's merely that the law is coming down so hard on these people who, and the law is to such an extent protecting anybody. To me, it's a freedom of speech issue that you can't do these. These people are doing horrendous crimes against animals, and you can't let people know who they are.
And of course, they always want to do it in secret, don't they?
So tonight also, we believe that Dr. Neil Barnard will be on Coast to Coast. And he was on last night for all of 2 hours. He is from the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, and so it should be on at 8 o'clock tonight. So on Coast to Coast on CFAN. Over to you.
Well, thank you very much for that, Carl. We've come to the end of our program. This is Animal Voices. You've been listening to CFRO 102.7 FM. My co-hosts have been Marge Adams, Carl Loskin, and on sound, that's Alan Jensen. My name is Allert. Please come back next week.